was to describe one facet of the secular culture, namely the self-understanding in terms of the four words that I put on the board: contingency, temporality, relativity, and autonomy. The self-understanding which makes talk about God unintelligible, meaningless, at least in terms of the way in which the world, or at least the way in which we view the world, the way in which we function in the world. Most people, on beginning a journey today, in contrast, let's say, to a religious culture, most people in beginning a journey today would check the oil and the gas and the spark plugs and the safety belts and so on, whereas 1,000 years ago they might have gone to a mass. We rely on the functioning of our automobile for our safety, not on some supernatural intervention. Or another illustration: if I were to fall convulsive to the ground, you would not immediately ask all the pastors here to exorcise a demon. You would call for a doctor to check for an epileptic seizure. So that the way we operate in the world, even if we would still say prayers for safe journeys and so on, the way we in fact operate is as if there were no God, or as if we did not need the hypothesis of God in order to explain, understand, operate in our world. Now, with that self-understanding, I tried to demonstrate that at least in the areas of that which controls us and over which we have no control, we experience the kind of thing that gives rise to talk about God, and also in the sense of our own humanity, that is, humanness as being responsible, accountable. What I tried to do, therefore, is to demonstrate the meaningfulness, at least, of the language about God. But when we do that, we run into the fact, the experience, that we are threatened by both our accountability and our lack of control over that which controls us. We are threatened by this. And therefore we build defenses against the threat. The power that controls us and over which we have no control, the structures that call us to account for the choices we are forced to make, are threatening to us. This is at least the kind of experience which in a religious culture was called the voice of God, and we hear that voice today, each in our own language. I concluded yesterday by reading the section from C.S. Lewis in which he says, if you're going to mess around with God, if you're going to start asking the question of God, you have to be prepared not to be comforted. In fact, you have to be prepared to have the terror in your existence exposed. What happens when we respond to that terror is generally destructive of ourselves, possibly, if we give in to the terror and to the despair, destructive of the world around us as we build our illusions to defend ourselves. It's very easy for us to puncture other people's illusions, to see through the excuses that others use for their behavior. We can see through them without any difficulty at all. And therefore, we are uneasy about our own defenses, constantly, therefore, seeking reassurance, blotting out, if at all possible, all of the voices of people and things that call our defenses into question, or achieving the kind of mastery in which we do not have to pay attention to the voices that call our defenses into question. Now, I think this accounts for the tyrannies that exist in the world as we quest for power and prestige to defend ourselves, to justify ourselves. It accounts for the alienations that take place in the world. In short, what we are really doing with all of the mess that we make of the world is to bear witness, literally, to the experience of God. Now, the question that I want to take up today, then, is the question of whether or not we can validly offer any kind of alternative to this sort of analysis. The Christian witness, at least, claims to be the proclaimer of that sort of an alternative. It claims to say we need not be threatened by this experience of God, because there is another word from God that has been said to us in Jesus Christ. The good news of Christianity is really, quite literally, that God is gracious. It's not that he exists, but that he is gracious. Grace means nothing less than unconditioned affirmation, which is neither indulgent nor exploitative. I ought to say that again. Grace means unconditioned affirmation, which is neither indulgent nor exploitative. I think it's important to add these words because all of us experience affirmations, or perhaps have experienced affirmations, which try to exploit us. Every time a salesman comes to your door, you are in danger of getting the kind of affirmation that exploits. He will say nice things about your decor or the location of your house, nice things about the landscaping and so on. But the purpose of this, of course, is to get you to buy something, a vacuum cleaner or World Book Encyclopedia or whatever it is he happens to be selling. That's exploitative affirmation. It received its perhaps most persuasive expression in Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. A lot of courses are still being offered all over the country in the Dale Carnegie method. It's quite simply exploitative affirmation. It's getting people to like you so that they will buy what you are selling or do what you want them to do. Indulgent affirmation is the kind of thing that we've probably experienced from grown-ups who want to get rid of us. Go ahead, do anything you like, they say, or here's some money, go buy yourself some candy, just to get us, in a sense, off their back. Neither of these are really affirming of us. The giveaway is, do what you want, I don't care, which really means I don't care about you. Or compliments and affirmations that will enable the person who is giving them to benefit. It bothered me just a little bit that that the most popular evangelism program today borrows heavily from the Dale Carnegie salesman method. By saying when you come to make your evangelism call, you first say 5 minutes of really nice things. Find something you can compliment. A picture, a plaque, a statue, a landscaping, carpeting, anything. But find something you can compliment. There have got to be, I think, more responsible ways for us to relate to each other. But the grace that I'm talking about is that kind of unconditioned affirmation which neither seeks to exploit us for the benefit of the affirmer nor to indulge us also for the benefit of the indulger or the affirmer who says, do what you want, I don't care. Grace is redemptive. That is to say, it takes our concrete situation into account and endeavors for our sake to deliver us from it. But grace is not optimism. It isn't saying everything's going to be all right or all things will work out for the good. When Bonhoeffer was on his way to the gallows, he said to Payne Best in the last words that we have of him, "For me, this is the end, but for me, the beginning of life." And I think in that sentence, "This is the end, but for me, the beginning of life," you have really what it means to trust grace. It means that in the face of the worst that is happening, and Bonhoeffer acknowledges that, this is the end. He knew that being caught up now by the police would lead very swiftly to his own death. In the face of acknowledging the worst that is happening, he nevertheless trusts in the grace of that power that permits it to happen. That is to say, our trust is not in the good things that are happening to us, but in the God through whom all things happen. Now the question then that this poses, if that's what grace is, and if that's what it means to trust in grace, to be able to face the worst, to be able to look reality full in the face, and not to despair, if that's what trusting grace is, then the question that we need to ask is, what grounds are there for this kind of affirmation, for this kind of statement about grace? Are we simply idiots? Are we blind to reality instead of facing reality when we trust grace? The Christian Church has said in its tradition and in its creeds that the grounding for its proclamation of God as gracious lies in the event of Jesus of Nazareth. That is to say, in a concrete event in history. Now, I'm leaving out here all kinds of stuff from the Old Testament that we could talk about, because the Old Testament too has grace as one of its themes. And the grounding for Israel's experience of grace lies also in history. If you look at the creeds of Israel from Deuteronomy 6, for example, you find that those creeds begin, "A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there and became a nation great and mighty, and fell into slavery, and the Lord delivered us from the bondage of Egypt and brought us into this land flowing with milk and honey." So in Deuteronomy 6 and Deuteronomy 26, where you have recorded Israel's liturgical equivalent of our Nicene Creed, you find that there too an event in history is appealed to as the grounds for trusting the grace of God. The whole book of Judges is an event to ground Israel's trust in God in his delivering, his continuously delivering Israel from occupying powers. But finally, in the Old Testament at least, each of these historical experiences of deliverance peters out and needs to be transcended. Finally, in the prophets of the exile, you find the proclamation that God himself will be the shepherd of Israel, and that the form in which God's grace will come is the form of the servant who suffers with and for the people. It's this last vision now that is picked up in the documents of the New Testament. Finally, I'm going to say, picked up by Jesus himself and lived out as Jesus' own vision. But the point I'm trying to make here, first of all, is that Christianity says the grounds for trusting the grace of God, or for proclaiming it and trusting it, lie in the event of Jesus. That is to say, in that particular historical event. But this raises a problem of monumental proportions in the contemporary secular culture, and that is the problem as to our access to the history of Jesus. Jesus wrote nothing. We have no documents from his hands. We do not even know with certainty what precisely took place in the event of Jesus. We know that there was such a figure in history, but we are 2 to 3 generations removed from those events in our present Gospels. Now, I'm going to ask you for a moment, at least, to suspend the notion that what we have in the Bible is a kind of revelation from God which we can take at face value. Because precisely that is what is challenged by the rise of the modern historical consciousness. The modern historical consciousness grew up with all the other things that constitute our modern world. The steam engine, the Industrial Revolution, the rise of technology, and the collapse of the religious worldview. I've put on the blackboard behind me 4 characteristics of the modern historical consciousness that we need to take into account in trying to get at the history of Jesus. Those 4 things are as follows. First of all, the historian today is not dependent upon his sources from the past, but he confers authority on the sources. That is to say, we do not simply pick up Caesar's Gallic Wars and read it as if it were telling us exactly what happened in the wars against Gaul. The reason for this is, of course, that that we take documents out of the past and give them a very critical interpretation. We have only one side of the story, for one thing, only Caesar's side. We never hear anything about Vercingetorix at all. I mean, he doesn't tell us his side of the story. We know very well that Caesar is probably going to make the story look as good for Caesar as possible. When Lyndon Johnson writes Vantage Point, we do not imagine for one moment that we are getting a true and accurate picture of the Johnson administration. We're getting Lyndon Johnson's side of the story. That is what we are getting. And we look for, as historians, you see, we look for all kinds of corroborating evidence. I mean, if I come home at 3 o'clock in the morning and tell my wife that the car broke down, she is going to practice the historian's craft at this point and probably want some corroborating evidence. That's what we do when we hear a story, you see, any kind of a story, a fish story, a car breakdown story. We look for corroborating evidence, above all when there's a quarrel going on. We certainly don't take one side of the story for granted. All of us, in that sense, practice being historians who decide what in our sources we are going to accept. That's what it means to confer authority on your sources. You don't just take them at face value. In making your judgment as to what in the story you're going to accept, you make a judgment in such a way that it can be tested by your peers, by other historians, by contemporaries. You, in other words, try to use sound and balanced reasoning. In order to arrive at your judgment, thirdly, you use many fields. History is not simply a field in itself, it is a field encompassing field. You use psychology. We know something about the psychology of people and of rulers in particular, presidents and kings, and we apply that to something like Caesar's Gallic Wars. We know something about sociology, about political science. We apply all of this to the sources, to the documents that we are studying, in order to arrive at a judgment. And finally, we use our own critically interpreted experience as a standard, as a measure. So, If the story tells us about resurrections, we are going to say, have we seen any lately? Answer, no. We will probably therefore assess low probability to any stories that claim to be telling us about resurrections from the dead. Now, this is the way historians work, all historians. And if we are going to work with ancient texts like the texts of the Bible as historians today, then these are the ways in which we will study those texts. Now, I think this is the kind of thing that gives many conservative Christians the willies. We're caught in a dilemma. We have a set of documents out of the ancient past, documents in our Bible. They contain all kinds of things that we have not, in fact, experienced. Resurrections and miracles, just some of them. We want to make a historical claim. Christianity is simply not a set of ideas quite independent of its historical circumstance. You can take the ideas of Socrates, for example. Whether or not Socrates ever conducted the dialogues that Plato describes, the teachings have validity quite apart from Socrates, certainly apart from his manner of living and dying. Has nothing to do with it. So all kinds of sayings and teachings can impress themselves upon us without any reference to the historical events. But Christianity's quite specific claim is that it is not a set of ideas, not a set of teachings, but that its central proclamation, God is gracious, is anchored in the historical happening of Jesus of Nazareth. And now we discover that the documents that give us access to that happening need to be subjected to the same kind of historical critique that we would subject the writings of Tacitus or Xenophon or Caesar or anybody else. Now, this is both frightening and offensive to people who say, but in the Bible we have the Word of God, and therefore we don't have to apply the same kind of canons of historical analysis. In fact, it's presumptuous of us, it's sinful and rebellious of us to apply historical analysis to these documents which we call the Word of God. But if we do not apply historical analysis to them, then we will really be challenged by the modern historical consciousness and to ask us whether we can continue to make the claims that we do. And then we usually retreat and say, well, it's a matter of faith. It's not a matter of knowing, it's a matter of faith. To which the historian would reply, as we have been disastrously led to apply by, to reply by Kant, okay, believing is then an inferior form of knowing. Believing is an inferior form of knowing. And you see, that's really the thing I'm trying to break through with what I'm saying. Van Harvey, who applies these criteria of the historian to the Christian proclamation, finally concludes that one cannot be both a historian and a believer, and that one must choose. Why? Because the morality of knowledge, the accepted moral way of knowing, he says, of the historian is totally incompatible with the morality of knowledge of the believer. And you can see that in every controversy that has to do with the historical analysis of the Bible. The believers say that the historical critic of the Bible is unfaithful, immoral, literally, indecent, blasphemous, a heretic to be cast out of the church because his way of knowing seems to be incompatible with the whole ethos, the whole makeup of the believer. And the historian, on the other hand, has contempt for the naivete, credulity, literally, of the believer, who accepts without question that axe heads float and men can live for 3 days in the belly of a fish, and God shapes man like sculpting him out of the ground and performs an act of artificial respiration or something like it to breathe life into him, and all this happened less than 7,000 years ago. The historian scoffs at all of this, and so you have a conflict between the historian and the believer, and it's a painful conflict because the believer is compelled to be making historical claims and to reject the very method by which the claims can be investigated. Now, I suppose you want to know how we're going to get out of this. Thought you'd never ask. We aren't. I'm going to quit the lecture and go. We're going to close up the Christian church. No, I... What? Run for the boat, yes. How do we break through this terrible conflict between the knowing of the historian and the knowing of the believer, which the historian regards as an inferior way of knowing, and which the believer regards as a superior way of knowing? How do we break through all of that? I want to add, by the way, I hope everybody understands this too, that I'm not just here trying to talk about a theoretical problem. The Missouri Synod conflict has as one of its central issues just this whole business of whether or not we can study the Bible historically and still be within the Christian community. Van Harvey concluded at the end of his book that he could not be a believer, and he left the seminary at which he was teaching and went to teach history at Temple University. All right, what can we do? I think the first thing to be said is that Christianity's claim is not that the miraculous happened. I'm not thereby denying miracles, but I'm simply saying that Christianity's good news is not that God performs miracles, at least the kind of miracles that usually get involved in these controversies. I think one of the places where we can begin is the same way that Mark's Gospel begins. If you read Mark's Gospel, you will find a very curious kind of document, and as far as we know, it's the earliest document. At least of the Gospels. It does not have birth narratives, that is, no miracles at the beginning, and it does not even have an account of a resurrection appearance of Jesus at the end. It has the proclamation that he has been raised, and the people who hear it are filled with great fear, and clunk, there the Gospel ends. But what we have in between those non-things, no birth narratives, you know, no angels, no annunciations to Mary. One of my friends says the first two people to doubt the virgin birth were Mary and Joseph. And if we read those stories carefully, we will see exactly what happened. You know, in this sense, it's really true that Mary is one of the great heroes of faith. If you read Luke 1, there comes this point where she arose with haste and went into the hill country. The way I imagine that is that she probably had a conversation with her mother that began, "Mother, I'm pregnant," and there was this angel, and right away she's packed off to the hill country. So all this time, you see, she really has to believe the virgin birth. So does Joseph. But Mark doesn't begin with that at all. And again, I'm not trying to say that it didn't happen. I'm simply trying to say that is not where the Christian faith begins. It is not the central proclamation at all. It is, in fact, both the birth narratives and the resurrection narratives are in fact conclusions about the central reality which is present in Mark's Gospel. And the central reality in Mark's Gospel is to be found in the 8th, 9th, and 10th chapters of the Gospel, each one of which has a prediction of the passion That is the prediction of the crucifixion of Jesus, coupled with a misunderstanding of the disciples that is rejected by Jesus, and finally teaching about discipleship, what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. And all of these three statements, in the eighth, in the ninth, and climaxing in the tenth chapter of Mark's Gospel, all of them have the cross as central. The claim that Jesus makes is not the claim to be God, but to be the embodiment of grace. He is, in the words of his enemies, the friend of sinners. That was the accusation brought against him. And the way in which he is the friend of sinners is precisely this unconditioned affirmation that I talked about. Zacchaeus is the best, well, I don't want to single out anyone, but it's, for me at least, the best story of this. Jesus comes to Jericho, and decides to eat at the house of Zacchaeus. It is like Gerald Ford coming to Seattle and deciding to eat with John Ehrlichman. Jesus comes to Jericho, and decides to eat at the house of Zacchaeus. It is like Gerald Ford coming to Seattle and deciding to eat with John Ehrlichman. Really? I mean, think of what this means. You know, I'm, in a sense, I'm not, again, I'm not saying it to knock somebody who's down. I'm trying to say, you know, Rockefeller, when he was interviewed for by the Senate for his vice presidential nomination, said, you know, I've gotten some letters from John Ehrlichman, and I'm ashamed to admit that I haven't even answered them. I mean, you know, being seen with John Ehrlichman is the kiss of death for a Republican politician. Literally, for Jesus to eat with Zacchaeus was like that. But he chooses Zacchaeus. He says, come down out of the tree. I'm going to have lunch at your house today. Zacchaeus was not only the most corrupt man in his village, but also the most hated. He was a venal man, if we know anything at all about tax collectors in those days, who was using the occupation of his country by a foreign power as an occasion to line his own pockets at the expense of his countrymen. Now, Jesus goes to have dinner with him, and it was characteristic of Jesus that he did this. Now, what happens there, we don't know. I mean, the table conversation is not recorded for us. But when the meal is over, and they come out to face the reporters from the Jerusalem Journal and the Jericho Gazette and so on, the reporters say, Mr. Zacchaeus, do you have a statement for us? And Zacchaeus says, I have indeed. Whatever I have stolen, I will give back fourfold. I tried to compare that with the tax scandals in Chicago when Daley was running for his fourth term, and the county assessor, Cullerton, I think, was discovered to be involved in all kinds of shenanigans. The single-family dwellings in Chicago were taxed at one rate, whereas the Gold Coast high-rise apartment buildings were taxed at a much lower rate, probably a fourth the rate of the individual dwellings, in return for substantial contributions to the Democratic Party's campaign chest, in Chicago. Cullerton went on television and he did not say, whatever we have stolen, we will give back fourfold. In fact, Daley's thoroughly discredited administration was just handsomely reelected this past spring, in spite of numerous evidences, court trials and so on, of financial shenanigans on the part of his closest associates. Nobody admitted anything, you know, but then Jesus probably didn't have dinner with P.J. Cullerton. But he had it with Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus emerges from that dinner a free man. Not only is he a free man in terms of his ability to accept responsibility for his past, but he is a free man in terms of his openness now to making restitution. Half my goods will go to the poor, he says. Now, you know, there's an astonishing vulnerability there on Zacchaeus's part, elicited by the encounter with Jesus. Zacchaeus is now trusting something other than what he had been trusting, and he is therefore free to confess, to repent, to make restitution. And Jesus acknowledges all of this by saying, today's salvation has come to this house. It's the same kind of word Jesus says to the thief on the cross, who breaks out of the environment of gallows humor, you see, in which all of the condemned are getting it and some are even giving it to each other, breaks out of this, still using the gallows humor language that was going on there in the public execution, and says, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus discerns that here this man has broken out of the destructive environment of gallows humor, and he says to him, today you will be with me. You know, it's the same kind of thing that he says to Zacchaeus. Today, in this moment, as you trust God, grace embodied in what I am doing, you are free. You are saved. You have salvation. Now, all of Jesus' parables are interpretations of this activity that he is embodying. I think that's the secret of the parables. They're not moral stories designed to make us behave better. They are interpretation stories, that is, stories interpreting what Jesus himself is up to, and not only the parables that we have misnamed, lost sheep, lost coin, lost son. They're not about that, prodigal son. They're about the searching shepherd, the seeking woman, the waiting, forgiving, prodigal father. He is really the prodigal one, you know, who starts it all over again, who recklessly expends his own self and substance on a son who has once already wasted his inheritance. All of the parables are in one sense or another about what Jesus is up to. He takes great risks. And his best parable is about that kind of risk-taking. I don't know whether it was even understood by his own contemporaries. It is the parable of the dishonest steward who is caught with his hand in the till or whatever, I don't know, and is fired. A man in middle management loses his job. What does he do? He gathers all his resources around him, right, in order to tide himself over to the next job or perhaps even retire if he can. But what does this guy do? He calls in the tenants and gives up his commission. Gives up his commission. Whatever is due him, he does not collect. They weren't paid salaries, you see. They were paid a commission on the rents they collected. That's what it meant to be a manager. And so he goes to the tenants and he says, how much do you owe? 100 barrels of oil. Take your bill and knock off my commission. I will not collect what is due to me. Now, this is a great risk. This is the risk that love always takes. It opens itself to being had. You know, and what are these people supposed to do? Maybe, he says, they will remember me when I am put out of my stewardship. That is, they may respond to this risk of generosity, you see. But then again, they may not. What obligation do they have? The bills have already been paid. The account settled. They owe him nothing. But he takes that kind of risk. So all of Jesus' parables are, in that sense, interpretations of what he is up to. The parable of the Good Samaritan included, you know, all of them. Now, finally, he is crucified for this. And that is the central affirmation that Christianity makes. The gospel is a word about the crucifixion. That is really what it is. Namely, that God himself enters into the mess that we have made of our world and endures it, takes it upon himself. Gerhard Ferdi, in his beautiful book, Where God Meets Man, says Jesus died in our place. That is not the same thing as saying he died in our stead. It's really saying much more than that. He died in our place. He died in the place where we die. He let it happen to him. The whole proclamation of Christianity is therefore a statement about Jesus in his death as the embodiment of the grace of God. So the confession, Jesus is God, is an attempt to say something about the crucifixion. The resurrection appearances are demonstrations in that sense that the death of Jesus was the death of God, the grace of God, the redemptive commitment of God to his suffering and sinful world. And so the birth stories are also ways of reading the event of Jesus, the crucifixion of Jesus, back also to the beginning, you see. Now, in other words, the place to start is where Mark starts. And what we are experiencing there is a claim. What the historian can investigate with all of his historical methods, being as critical as necessary, is a claim made by Jesus, and the same claim being made in the proclamation about him, so that there is no discontinuity between what Jesus claimed to be himself when he heals the paralytic. You know, he says, "Take heart, your sins are forgiven." The man who looks at his own paralysis wonders what God is doing to him, you see. And therefore Jesus' word to him is, "Take heart, God is your friend, your sins are forgiven." It was a word that caused all the people around to say, "Who is saying this? What kind of blasphemy is going on?" But that's where you see the claim being made in its most pregnant sense, not in the miracles, not in the kinds of things that we always worry about defending, but in the shocking, offensive, shattering word that God himself has committed himself to us unconditionally in the death of Jesus. But now the word about the death of Jesus in Mark's gospel is always coupled with a word about discipleship. You too, you see, will drink my cup and be baptized with my baptism. You can take up the cross and follow me. So that to be invited into the death of Jesus is to be invited so to trust the grace of God that we can participate in God's vulnerability for the world, in God's suffering for the world. Paul says in an astonishing statement that he completes in his own suffering the sufferings of Jesus Christ. Well, God is the kind of God who throughout the Bible invites us into partnership with him. To confess God as creator is to become partners with God in the creation. You see, that's the great character of the Christian confession of God as creator. We make ourselves, God has made us co-responsible with him for the ordering of this world. That's what the whole ecological word is saying to us today. Now Jesus makes us responsible with him for God's redemptive vulnerability in the world. To trust grace is therefore to accept the claim that is being made by Jesus and about him, namely, that suffering love is redemptive love. That's what it means to trust grace. So that I am put into the same position as Zacchaeus and Peter and James and John and Mary and Joseph and all the rest, not as a privileged person looking back on the resurrection and saying, well, I don't have to wonder whether it's all true. I've got a secure statement. Maybe the historical critic is doing us a favor by ripping away these kinds of false props that we might have had and confronting us once again nakedly with the only thing that can be established historically, namely, Jesus was crucified. Now the question is, do we trust the claim that is being made by and for the crucified one, that there and there only God's grace has happened? You see, to trust that claim then enables us to enter into the whole testimony of the New Testament. There isn't any other way. If we start with the Bible, then we end up simply being defenders of the Bible and attackers of our brothers. If we start with the cross and trust it, we don't have to be defenders of the Bible. We can be receivers of it. We can join in its witness because we trust what has happened in the cross as the great Word of God to us and for us. I could say a few more things at this point, but I think maybe it would be a good place simply to stop and have some response. What I want to do tomorrow is to take up the relevance of the church. I want to raise some sociological questions and talk about what it means to experience God as the Holy Spirit. Well, where are you after all of this?
Water, that was
relief.
Beautiful. Oh, that was beautiful.
Start arguing with it.
I can't.
Oh, you can't.
Do you have to go beyond the death in order to make it more valid for us in that he was resurrected? It didn't stop with the death. And, you know, if a man died, that doesn't... What value is that?
Yes.
Isn't our hope in the fact that he was raised from the dead?
Well, I don't know whether I want to put it that way. Yes, the question was, can we stop with the resurrection, or stop with the death of Jesus? Is our hope in the resurrection? I think we have to say, first of all, no, nobody stops with the crucifixion. What I'm trying to say is that the crucial moment for faith, that is the decisive, the critical moment of believing, is in the encounter with the crucified one. The church's confession, Jesus is Lord, is a confession about the crucifixion. That is the form that his lordship takes. Mark 10 again. The Gentiles lord it over each other and exercise power over each other. But it shall not be so among you. And then he has this servant word. Whoever would be greatest shall be the least. Whoever would be first among you shall be your servant. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. So he's interpreting lordship there. To confess Jesus as Lord is to say something about the crucifixion. Now, the resurrection appearances of Jesus are the experience of the saving efficacy of the cross. And in that sense, I would say, you cannot stop with the crucifixion. But the grounds for Christian hope and the grounds for Christian faith are in the crucifixion. In the same way that Christmas is not the gospel. It is a conclusion. It is something that we celebrate as a result of faith in the gospel. It is the way of confessing the gospel that Jesus, the crucified one, is God's commitment to us, a way of celebrating that backwards, so to speak, not only to his birth, but to all eternity. What I'm trying to do is, in one sense at least, to focus again on the path which the early Christian community took in its proclamation. It started with the experience of the crucifixion and expanded into the experiences of the risen Jesus and the confessions about his birth. Now, if as historians, you know, we start with the resurrection and the birth, then we're going to end up like Van Harvey. We're going to end up not being Christians anymore. We're going to say the modern historical consciousness can't deal critically and responsibly with virgin birth narratives and resurrection narratives. It can't. So Harvey leaves Christianity altogether. Or we're probably going to try to abstract the set of ideas out of Christianity, which is independent of the historical events, and I think that's equally destructive of Christianity. Or we are going to try to lift the Bible out of historical investigation altogether. But when we do that, when we say, this can't be investigated historically, then we make the faith commitment, first of all, a commitment to the Bible and not a commitment to the gospel. So, you know, all three of these ways seem to me to be disastrous and destructive of Christian faith. And the way out of this, for me at least, or at least the way I see out of this, is to start where Mark begins. That the crucifixion is the central event, that we are called upon to trust that, and trusting that, we will receive everything else. We will have it all given back to us again. So that the critical moment of believing is not believing something that the historian cannot demonstrate, but believing something the historian can demonstrate very well, namely that Jesus was crucified and claimed as he was going to his death that crucifixion was the event of God. That's what a historian can demonstrate. Now, this leads me to add one final principle, you see. Faith, Christian faith, arises at that point where the options become intelligible to us. What are the options? Either to go on trusting our own self-made defenses, or to trust God's defense of us in the crucifixion of Jesus. But to trust God's defense of us in the crucifixion of Jesus means that I am free, like Zacchaeus, to confess my sins and to make restitution. This is why simply knowing what the options are doesn't mean people are going to trust them. It means, in fact, that there's a high probability that they will be rejected. That's the offense of the cross, that it makes possible my confessing my sins. But that's exactly what I don't want to do. And therefore, I will be a crucifier of the truth-sayers. Keith, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I want to say that the disciples, after the crucifixion, by the accounts we have, themselves were under some kind of defeat thing. They were hiding, and so forth. So that finally, something happened, even to them.
Yes.
To have been with them.
Yes.
To lift them up and pull them into the kind of commitment or proclamation that finally happened. And I know that you're not leaving that out, but for me, I need to hear that to help me so that I don't now somehow commit myself on my own strength, you know, to this thing which I believe. I believe what you're saying about this suffering, but as soon as I try to commit myself to that, then I begin to try to lift my own suffering up by my own power, see? And that's the one thing the disciples apparently couldn't do either. They finally couldn't have the necessary faith, and they were walking with him, right? But something happened. Is that making sense at all? Something happened to them that they didn't offer.
Yes. I'm talking about what we can investigate historically.
Yeah, I know. I love that. That's great.
Okay.
Does this follow at all?
Yes. What the historian can investigate is the claim of the disciples. But I am not asked to trust the claim of the disciples. I think my first call to trust is the claim of Jesus. That's all I'm trying to say. I think that's the limitation of what I've tried to do this morning. I'm trying to say that the historian who wants to locate the claims of Christianity in the miraculous and at both ends of the story of Jesus, the virgin birth, the resurrection, is missing the point. I mean, that's when you can really separate faith and knowledge. And so I'm trying to get at it again in a different way. This is a very limited effort, you know, and we have to recognize its limitations. Otherwise, I would agree with you. Yeah. Whew. Is it warm in here, or am I just warm?
It's the hot seat, we call it.
It's the hot seat. Yes. I thank you for sharing this hour, and tomorrow I'm going to be back same time, same place, to try to talk about one further assault of secularism, namely the church's own capitulation to the role assigned to it in a secular culture. And I think that has led to a kind of false relevance, and I'd like to see if we can't recover some authentic relevance. Okay, see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Walter.